This is a podcast from ABC Radio National. This program can be heard broadcast or streamed from ABC Radio National. Details of frequencies, times, and more downloads, abc.net.au/rn.
ABC Radio National, The Science Show number 1521, and this week we bring you Green Nylon, Lemur Ladies in Charge, and this. Paparazzi? No, it's the digital camera's 30th birthday. Hello again, I'm Robin Williams. We start in Cambridge. That's where Sir John Myrick Thomas has launched Green Nylon, part of a revolution in chemistry that's made headlines around the world. And it's worth billions. Sir John was here this week as a guest of Sydney University, which gave him an honorary degree. So what about the nylon?
It's made mainly from carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and hydrogen, right? It's a wonderful textile. It's in car manufacture, it's in carpets, in clothes, etc. Millions upon millions of tons are produced annually throughout the world. In the method of preparation that's been worked out, and about the only way so far you can of manufacturing it, you generate four times as much, approximately, of ammonium sulfate as you do of nylon. So nylon is essentially a byproduct in the process. Now, ammonium sulfate is a very low-grade fertilizer. It's really a landfill, and it's a problem. Furthermore, it's a pretty nasty process in the sense that you need oleum, that's fuming sulfuric acid, or you can have hydroxylamine hydrosulfate, which is potentially very explosive. There have been many explosions all over the world because of these reagents. And it's a two-step process. It runs at quite high temperature. And A, you're using aggressive reagents. B, they're very potentially dangerous. C, you generate a massive amount of unnecessary material. Now, my colleague and I, Dr. Robert Raja, he's my right-hand man, we had the idea a couple of years ago, actually, that we could, using just air and ammonia and the fundamental building block, which is called cyclohexanone, which everybody had to use, you get that from petroleum. With that, using our specially designed catalyst, now this is where the trick comes in, and this is what I'm really proud of.
You're the catalyst man, of course.
I am the catalyst man, that's quite true. We designed a solid, de novo, from beginning, which was full of holes. It had pores running in mutually perpendicular directions. So any reagent or product or reactant that goes in, or air or ammonia, can weave its way three-dimensionally through this material. Now, peppered or sprinkled on the internal surface of these highly porous material, we could place in strategic positions an acid center and a sort of oxidation center. Now, this meant that in one go, you could start from the reactants and end up with caprolactam, which is the stepping stone to nylon. And that's the revolutionary part of it. It's elicited interest all over the world. We published it in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science in September.
And it's been reported in Nature recently.
It's been
as well.
Reported in Nature, in the New York Times, in all sorts of places, in chemical engineering news, in European business news, etc. We're very pleased with it because we're using a principle, Robin, that is very important and is widely applicable. I can design a solid now because I've realized, and this has been something that I've been pioneering for the last 20 years, I know how to build open structure solids. See, if I give you a lump of quartz or a lump of iron, it's close packed, no spaces between those atoms. But there are materials in nature, zeolites they're called, which if you heat them and drive away the water from them, they're full of gaps. There are holes that run and weave their way either in one dimension or two dimension or three dimension. Well, we can design other materials that are like that. They're aluminium phosphates, actually, and that's pretty benign. Aluminium is cheap, phosphorus is cheap. And we can insert these active sites in there, catalytically active. It's like making an inorganic enzyme, because the shape recognizes the size yes. of the molecule, you see. And we can produce the products in situ. So not only do we have a solid, which is a catalyst, magically the solid is also the receptacle in which you're carrying out the reaction.
Well, that's terrific. Does it actually save the use of water in this process as well?
Absolutely. I mean, many of the reactions that we carry out do not require solvents at all. That's another important crusade at the moment, you see, because solvents usually have a vapor pressure. And you know that this contributes to the greenhouse effect, and it gives rise to emissions, which are often harmful for the nation or the world's health. So if you can avoid the use of solvents, and this is why the solids that we are building, we have a strategic principle there. So I can stand back and say, now what reaction do I want to carry out next? Let's now work out how I can build up a precursor to another type of polymer, another plastic, or how can I build up another oxygen-containing agent which gives me another fabric and so forth. So we're very pleased with that, and my recent papers have, as it were, hit the headlines without being too bombastic in saying that, because people have realised that we have a principle that's widely applicable.
What about applying it when it comes to nylon? How long will it take to get the infrastructure, the factories changed around?
You're absolutely right. Well, at first, we have to say that our degrees of conversion is closer to 80% rather than 95% of the sort of reactants that you put in, measured by the products that you pull out. Now, industrially, you try and get somewhere near 100%. Now, we've laid down the principles. No doubt about it, optimization can now take place, you see. Now, because we were challenged by the Dutch state mines, who happened to have a loose connection with us in Cambridge, to try and produce hydroxylamine in situ. You see, the hydroxylamine, hydrochloride or hydrosulfate, as I said earlier, is very explosive. There were huge explosions in Britain. You remember the Flixborough disaster?
Oh, perhaps? Terrible, yes.
That was caused by that, you see. So if we could produce hydroxylamine in situ from air and ammonia, it would be magic. We said, well, we can do it. And when we did it, they gave us a little sum of money. And then they said, well, we'll patent this for you. And they've done that. So we are on the patent, so are they. But they're now no longer interested in caprolactam and in nylon 6. And consequently, owing to the terms of the patent, we can't now talk to other potential major manufacturers of caprolactam for another 6 months or a year or so.
Yes.
But they are already, we know. You can read, you know, the messages that are coming through, as it were.
So when do you think this revolution in manufacturing?
It's difficult to tell, because as you rightly say, there can be all manner of things that will be hindering the utilization of it in a full scale, because the big companies, the Japanese, European, German especially, American companies, they've set up capital investment on a massive scale. And they're not going to suddenly say, having spent £10 billion, shall we say, we're going to make nylon 6 in the traditional method, but now Thomas and his crowd in Cambridge have got another one, let's scrap it. They're not going to do that, are they? Not immediately, not overnight. But so gradually there'll be a phasing in and a phasing out.
And you thought chemistry was all over and done. Sir John Myrick, Thomas is the former master of Peterhouse College, Cambridge, the College of Kelvin, Whittle, Perutz and Roger Scruton, not to mention James Mason. The naked scientist Chris Smith is at Trinity College, and his news this week from the journal Nature could save the Earth from oblivion. Chris.
Throughout our history, things smashing into the Earth have made, quite literally, a lasting impact on the way our planet has developed. A brush with a Mars-sized planet gave us the Moon, and something a bit smaller wiped out the dinosaurs. But ideally, we'd like to avoid the same thing happening to humans. Astronomers can now spot objects which are on likely collision courses with the Earth from a long way off. But can we avoid an inevitable smash? Ed Liu is a NASA astronaut at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas.
The problem that we're trying to solve here is what you would do when someday you find an asteroid that's about to hit the Earth. And typically, you expect to have maybe 20 years or several decades advance notice. And people have had a lot of ideas for how you might push one of these things, mostly involving landing on these asteroids and pushing them or blowing them up or so on. For a lot of reasons, it turns out that blowing things up doesn't work very well. But the idea of simply landing on it and pushing also turns out to not be so simple, because most of these things rotate, and most of these things have very low surface gravity, meaning you don't stick to the surface. So if you're trying to hold on to the surface, you have to find some way to either drill in or attach yourself or so on. But since we don't know what the surfaces really look like, that's kind of a tall order also.
So what do you think the solution could be then, Ed?
So we came up with an idea, which is not bother landing on it, but instead to hover above the surface of an asteroid and use the force of gravity pulling from the asteroid to your spacecraft to pull a thing in the way that a tractor pulls a piece of machinery, except, of course, that there's no line in between there. Gravity is your tow line.
But presumably, because the amount of gravity exerted by this fairly small object, i.e. your spacecraft's going to be quite small, this is going to be a long-term project, isn't it?
Exactly. But remember that you, in general, will have many decades of advance notice, so you do have time. And it turns out that even though the force of gravity is quite weak, we're talking about maybe a newton or so, which in ordinary terms is about what you would use to, say, hold up a book. Even that small amount of force over, say, a year's time adds up to a fair amount. And if you do such a thing to an asteroid, even that push, say, a couple of decades ahead of time, that's enough to actually push an asteroid away from an Earth impact, were that thing headed for an impact with the Earth.
So how many years in advance would we have to be working in order to achieve satisfactory diversion of something which is on an Earth-bound course?
Well, the example we use in a paper is for a 200-meter asteroid, which is large enough to cause, say, destruction of a large city or something like that. Using a spacecraft that was about 20 tons, which is about the size of things that people are proposing for deep space, high-efficiency propulsion satellites or spacecraft, you could do this with about 20 years advance notice, and given that you could have this thing on station for about a year's time. So meaning, say we were today going to find an asteroid that was going to impact 20 years from now, and we were to able to launch the spacecraft today, then the spacecraft could go to this asteroid, hover in front of it for about 1 year's time, then go away, and that would be enough to prevent the impact about 20 years from now.
NASA astronaut Ed Liu from the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, describing his idea for a gravity-powered asteroid tractor.
And it's published in the journal Nature this week, thanks to Chris Smith, who, as I said, is at Trinity College in Cambridge. His previous Vice-Chancellor was Sir Alec Browers, the engineer from Melbourne, and we had him on ABC Radio National a couple of weeks ago. The present Vice-Chancellor is Professor Alison Richard, who, it is said, has turned her knowledge of the behaviour of primates to good use in running the university.
I started out in Madagascar doing my PhD work there many eons ago, 35 years ago, 1970. I went out as a sort of wet behind the ears, completely ignorant 21-year-old and spent 18 months in Madagascar. The question I was trying to answer was the degree to which the environment drives and shapes social organisation. And I studied a species, the shifaka, this big, white, beautiful lemur that lives in spiny forests in the very dry south and in quite luxuriant wet forests in the northwest of the island. So I spent 9 months in both places comparing the social systems of these animals in these two different forests. And I came up with some differences, and it was not uninteresting, but the truth of the matter is that as I look back on it, I wasn't actually really going after what I now consider to be the really interesting questions about these animals, which I have been studying more or less ever since. So, you know, what are those questions? Well, Madagascar has been sort of floating off in the Indian Ocean, isolated from the rest of the world for 80, 90, perhaps 120 million years. And it is, as Alison Jolly memorably put it, as if time had flowed to the present through a different channel. A more prosaic way of saying it, perhaps, is that the animals haven't read the textbooks. They don't know how they're supposed to behave. And so actually, they break a lot of rules, as we understand rules of behaviour to be. And studying the rule breakers is a very interesting way of understanding the rules and gaining insight into the rules. And perhaps the most famous aspect of lemur behaviour that is rule breaking is that in most, not all, but most species, and certainly the one in which I study, females are socially dominant to males. In fact, it's enough for a female just to look at a male, and the male will roll his tail up between his legs and cringe and chatter his lips and look thoroughly subordinate, which indeed these males are, at least almost all of the year, at the birth season and the mating season, things change a little. But the big question really is how to explain the fact that we have female social dominance in Madagascar amongst most of these lemurs, whereas males are socially dominant among, and usually bigger than females, in most other non-human primates, and indeed in most mammals.
Okay, when you were studying, when you are studying these creatures, what do you do? Sit like Jane Goodall in the forest inobtrusively for, you know, some months, and then they get used to you and you watch a little more? Or is it easier than that? Can you move in with a pair of binoculars and kick off straight away?
Well, either because they're very forgiving or because they're quite stupid, the lemurs that I study are very easily habituated, and I can get within 4 or 5 feet of them. I don't need binoculars. In fact, often when I'm trying to use my binoculars, I'm too close to the wretched animals and my binoculars won't focus on them. So they live at very high densities. You can get extremely close to them. The forest is very low in southern Madagascar. The highest trees are maybe 30, 40 feet, and the animals are often either on the ground or quite close to the ground. So it is as close to heaven as any field researcher could hope to aspire. And I must say that I look at people like Jane Goodall, who've gone out and done really hard things, studying animals that are really elusive and really difficult to habituate, living in very difficult conditions, with great admiration, and just feel glad that that's not what I have to do. But in terms of what we actually are doing, since 1984, I've been studying a population in southwest Madagascar with colleagues in Madagascar and with students from Madagascar, as well as my own graduate students. And we have used a blowgun with darts loaded with anesthetic under pressure, and we dart the animals in the trees. They go to sleep. We catch them in sheets as they fall out of the trees, take them back to camp, weigh them, measure them, give them collars and tags, take samples, dental impressions so that we can estimate their ages if we don't know when they were born, take them back out into the forest again when they're awake, release them, and now we've captured over 700 animals in the 20 years we've been doing this study. Essentially every animal that either migrates into this population or is born into this population is marked within a year of birth or within a year of it moving into the population. And so we now have an extraordinary, I believe actually almost unique, understanding of the dynamics of this primate population. You know, births, deaths and marriages, if you want to call it that. One of my former graduate students, Diane Brockman, has been looking at, if you will, the soundtrack to the silent movie in terms of the endocrinological picture of what's going on with these animals, testosterone levels, estrogen levels, by taking fecal samples and doing analysis of fecal samples, so we can get an understanding of the moods of males in particular, but also females over time and their hormonal cycles. And another of my former graduate students now, Richard Lawler, has been doing DNA analysis. So we actually now know not only who are the mothers of all of the offspring in the population, but who are the fathers as well. So we can start to look at the tactics and strategies of males and females in the sort of the reproductive game that plays itself out in the population. It's absolutely fascinating.
Have you come any close to working out how they tore up the rule book or actually never read it, and how they developed this unusual social hierarchy that you described before?
I think that the key to the question is that conditions in Madagascar are unusually, particularly in this region of Madagascar, but in fact in Madagascar in general, are unusually difficult and unpredictable. And we have good evidence of that now. A study done, in fact, quite independently by my husband, who's an archaeologist and who has his own interest in this, looking at levels of unpredictability of rainfall in tropical regions of the world, including northern Queensland, I might say. This should interest you. It turns out that there are peaks of unpredictability in terms of catastrophic failure of rainfall on a 10-year cycle. Madagascar is one of the hot spots in the world, along with northern Queensland, of high levels of unpredictability in terms of rainfall. Now, what do you do when you live in a very unpredictable environment? Well, you hedge your bets, first. And second, we believe that this makes for a particularly stressful life for females who are trying to survive and reproduce across this very unpredictable, uncertain climatic regime in Madagascar, which we have every reason to believe has been there for millions of years. Madagascar sits geologically, if you will, in a very interesting place in the world that has probably made it a difficult place to live. We believe that there are features of Madagascar's climate that drive females to be ready to face down males in the competition for resources more than primate females are ready to do in other parts of the world, and that it is necessary for females to assert themselves in order to get access to extremely scarce or unpredictably extremely scarce resources.
So where you've got stability and predictability, you tend to get men in charge.
I wouldn't say that. People have said to me, do I believe, and it was said to me a lot when I became Vice-Chancellor at Cambridge, is it good training for being Vice-Chancellor of a university to be studying non-human primates in a third world country? To which my answer is no. If you want to study people, you study people. And I'm very sceptical that lemurs can tell us directly anything about people. But I am interested fundamentally in the evolution of social complexity and why there is a diversity of social systems amongst our closest relatives and why, in fact, the diversity isn't greater. If you look across the 300 or so species of primates that we know in the world, there isn't an infinite variety of social systems. There is a quite finite variety of social systems, of which the lemurs represent an actually quite anomalous and unusual and, as I say, rule-breaking variety. That's what's interesting to me. Now then, of course, it's always fun to think about the evolution of human social systems in that context. But I think that the study of these non-human primates at best can provide an envelope for thinking about the evolution of human social systems. It sort of puts boundaries on the system. But you can't go from lemur males to men.
Wouldn't even think of it. The Vice-Chancellor of Cambridge, number 3 in the world, according to the latest charts just published. Professor Alison Richard joins me at length in Conversation this week on Thursday evening at 7:40 on ABC Radio National. And on Tuesday evening coming up, you can see the last of the Sex in the Bush series, which, as we are all well aware, is less about lust than about the exchange of genetic material. Same for you and me, no doubt. I mean, what else could sex be for? Just listen.
Darling.
Darling, you know, I used to think it was your eyes I was attracted to.
Yes, darling.
Now I know I was wrong.
Yes, darling.
It's your innate qualities as a breeding partner that I can't resist.
Oh, darling.
Something tells me our offspring would be healthy and survive to reproduce.
Oh, darling.
Oh, yes, darling. Can't you hear our DNA is calling to one another?
Helix. Helix.
Oh, chromosome.
Oh, helix. Imagine my genes replicating with yours.
Oh, darling, don't.
Oh, but I must. A force greater than us is pushing us together.
It's chemistry.
No, it's more like paleobiology.
Oh, darling, imagine if we mutate.
Oh, you don't mean...
Yes, we might create something with a slight advantage over the others.
Perhaps it'll be resistant to new viral strains.
Oh, darling, when you talk like that...
Or it may be able to digest complex polymers.
Oh, darling, you have beautiful genomes.
Darling, give me all 23 of your chromosomes.
Oh, darling, X, 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 Y, X, Y, I don't care.
Deoxy, ribose, nucleic acid, I want you now.
Oh, darling.
Oh, darling.
Settle down, that's better. It's interesting, some digital cameras don't need to make noises at all, but have them built in to make you feel better. However, did you know the digital camera's 30th birthday is coming up in December? Well, the camera's inventor, Steve Sasson, has been here in Australia to help us celebrate.
It started out as a technical exercise. I was challenged with trying to take a new device called the charge-coupled device and do some imaging with it. And these devices were crude by today's standards. And the first device that I got my hands on was one made by Fairchild Corporation. It was a 100 by 100 array device, 10,000 pixels. Now, small by today's standards, but large at then. It was the biggest one back then. And I sort of took the assignment and turned it into creating a camera. And I took a digital approach. And it took us about a year before we took our first picture.
When was this?
We started in late 1974 and took my first picture in December of 1975.
What did the picture look like then?
It was shown on a black and white television and was recorded on a digital cassette tape, like an audio cassette tape, but it was digital signals. And when it was read off into a homemade frame store because there was no PCs at that time. And it showed up on the TV screen. We duplicated the lines to be about 400 lines. Didn't have nearly the resolution you're used to looking at with television, but it was certainly recognizable.
Okay, what was the next stage? How did you take it through to the almost miraculously accurate pictures we get now?
Well, it was a long, long road. The very first prototype that we were just talking about really asked a lot of questions. It said, what would have to happen to the different elements of the photographic chain as depicted in this prototype in order to make it realistic? And when we looked at it, we knew that digital imaging CCDs would have to be much higher resolution with color. And Kodak actually had a significant effort that was started to try to look at CCDs. In fact, we still manufacture CCDs today. We also looked at digital memory and digital signal processing, and there was a lot of different activities that went on there. So really, you had a list of technologies that had to be developed, and it took us 15 to 20 years. That was the prediction back in 1975. It would take about 15 to 20 years in order for this thing to start to mature to the point of being available for consumers.
Did you know how it would really take off and how, in fact, old-fashioned film might be placed in jeopardy?
We knew that filmless photography definitely was going to happen. The challenge to the camera was, back then, remember, there was no internet, local printing, or wide bandwidth cable connections. So the question really was asked, why would anybody want to look at their pictures on television? And that's a good question. But when you take a look at all the other things that came along that enabled digital cameras, being able to transmit your images or print your images anywhere you want, then you start to see the real usefulness of it. Well, we really didn't envision those developments back in 1975. But we still felt that this was too important a thing to ignore.
Had you any idea that it would be linked to mobile phones?
Didn't even know about mobile phones back then. So no, we did some initial thinking about looking at the different technical elements of the chain. But those other developments were beyond my thinking back in 1975.
When did it become, I can't really remember this because between you and me, I don't even have a camera.
Oh, that's terrible.
It's slightly embarrassing. When did digital picture-taking really take off?
Well, for the mass market consumer, I would say around the year 2000 and 2001. Kodak, as you know, has a long history of not only innovating in the imaging field, because we're an imaging company primarily, but we want to make it easy for the customer. Going back all the way to George Eastman in the 1880s, where he said, you press the button, we do the rest. Well, we introduced the concept called Easy Share. And cameras to be very easy to use. You just place the camera on the dock, you press the button, and it was downloaded to your computer. That made it useful for people because you really didn't have to sit down and understand all the idiosyncrasies of the imaging chain. We used to call it the chain of pain that you had to go through with the early cameras. So it started to take off then. Plus, I think those other developments that I alluded to before, printing, wide bandwidth cable, they were coming into their own around that time.
And have they really made film redundant?
I think there'll always be a place for film, but I don't think it's going to have nearly the place that it had in the past.
What will be the place for film?
I think film has some unique attributes because, of one, its size. You can have enormous negatives with very high resolution. Certainly, artistically, there's a lot that you can do with film that people like to do. So there are niches that will go forward. Professionals still like to use, in some cases, film for special applications and aerial work film. So it'll have applications, but not nearly the mass market that we have today.
And, of course, the movies themselves, they're going to be distributed, are they not, via digital signal. You won't have those great big reels delivered around from cinema to cinema anymore.
Yes, the technology's in place. I think most of the issues with respect to having that propagate have a lot to do with standards and the business model, but I think some new standards have been just agreed to, and pretty soon you'll start to see some of that happen as well.
And, of course, your competitors are joining the frolic, aren't they?
There's always competitors.
Yes.
Yes.
How did they actually work? Now, you obviously patented the system. Where did your version, if you like, stop and the general technology take over for others to exploit?
Well, the first prototype just demonstrated what had to be done. An image had to be captured on an electronic sensor, had to be stored in a digital memory in the camera, and then transferred to a more permanent storage. So those three steps had to take place. And those three steps are still even done today. So it's sort of defined the problem for us. But obviously, the technology that's being applied today was far in excess of what we had back then. Our latest camera, the EasyShare 1, for example, is about the same size, believe it or not, as the original cassette that I used to record those first images. So I have an entire camera, which is Wi-Fi capable, has a beautiful display on there so you can capture images, you can do albums with them, and you can instantly share over a Wi-Fi network. That all in the same about same volume as the original cassette that I used in the first camera.
And how small can it get?
Oh, it can get pretty small. I think we're limited now by the size of our fingers. Yeah.
Well, that's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And is that the push to get smaller and smaller, or what really are the challenges left in front of you?
Well, I think image quality for the average consumer has largely been conquered with several megapixel sensors that we have today. But think of some of the features like the Wi-Fi that I talked about before. Now you can instantly share an image. Well, that adds a new capability to cameras. And I think, you know, really the future is sort of limitless with respect to photography. There are more images being taken today than ever before. There are more uses for images, more things you can do with images as an average consumer today than ever before. So it's hard to guess at where we're going with images. I just know that it's pretty bright.
Must get a camera. Steve Sasson, the inventor of the digital camera, who's with Kodak in Rochester, New York, here celebrating its 30th birthday. Also 30, apart from the science show, of course, is Synroc, the means, perhaps, to dispose of nuclear waste. Pauline Newman.
In the decades since nuclear power stations first started up, there's been the problem of what to do with the tons of high-level radioactive waste they've produced. The French have turned it into glass, and the Swedes are planning to bury it in copper canisters deep in the ground. Much high-level waste throughout the world is being stored underwater, protected by high security, near where it was produced, allowing it to cool down whilst a decision is awaited on its ultimate fate. The best solution for dealing with the high-level radioactive waste was proposed in Australia about 30 years ago by the late Ted Ringwood, who was a professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at the ANU. He came up with the concept of Synroc, a type of synthetic rock that would bind the radioactive elements and hold them safely indefinitely. Here's Ted Ringwood on the Science Show back in 1980.
Well, the objective in Synroc is to immobilise the very highly radioactive elements that have to be prevented from reaching the biosphere for very long timescales to produce a waste form which, when buried in the earth, will not leak over timescales of like a million years, the timescale needed for decay of these radioactive byproducts to safe levels. An important principle used in Synroc is that we are actually copying the way nature performs this function. All natural rocks contain small amounts of uranium and thorium, which are radioactive and remain so for billions of years. These become incorporated in natural minerals at lattice sites. In fact, are locked up very tightly. We've developed an analog process to this. We're using very rare minerals in a very unique combination, and each of these minerals in nature has displayed the ability to lock up radioactive elements for hundreds and even thousands of millions of years without any leakage, even when they are subjected to higher temperatures, higher pressures, and more intense leaching conditions than they would ever be subjected to in a geological repository.
It was a great idea, a technology far superior to anything else available or on the horizon, with the potential to make a lot of money for Australia. It attracted worldwide interest from the nuclear industry, and ANSTO, the Australian Nuclear Research Organisation, built a demonstration production plant. But still, the technology wasn't selling. Here's Ted Ringwood on The Science Show in 1991.
The lead times for developing new technologies in the nuclear industry are very long. On top of that, there are advantages in allowing the waste to cool off for perhaps 20 to 40 years before it is put underground. The fact is, you see, the most heat-producing elements, cesium-137 and strontium-90,
have half-lives of about 25 or 30 years. So if you store these safely for an extended period, they are much cooler when they're placed underground. So I would expect to see Synroc used not in the next decade, but probably starting about 15 to 20 years down the track. Then I'm quite confident that Synroc will be a major player.
And Ted Ringwood was spot on with his timescale. Now, at last, Synroc is starting to earn money. At Anstow, near Lucas Heights on the outskirts of Sydney, Chief Research Scientist Dr. Lou Vance has been working with the synthetic rock for decades.
It's really designed for high-level waste, which is actually waste formed by reprocessing of spent fuel from power reactors. And, of course, Australia doesn't have any high-level waste. What we're trying to do is to sell that technology to other countries who have high-level nuclear waste.
As Lou Vance told me, Synroc is really the best way for getting rid of the most dangerous form of nuclear material. It's normally thought to be too expensive a method for dealing with anything less extreme. But in spite of the cost, the Australian government is considering the Synroc option for treating its own, much less dangerous, so-called intermediate-level waste. This is a byproduct from making the radioisotopes that are used in our hospitals and clinics for medical procedures. And it's been produced in the Lucas Heights reactor for the past 30 years. Lou Vance.
Those wastes are very rich in uranium, and we have a plant here that's scheduled to convert them into a variety of Synroc.
Okay, well, show me how you combine it with the Synroc to make it safe.
Okay, well, the wastes arising from the radioisotope processing are basically an aqueous solution of uranium nitrate. So the first thing that's going to happen to that material is it's going to be dried, because when it's just in tanks, as a radioactive liquid, it presents quite a hazard. Like if the tank sort of breaches because it rusts or something, then there's going to be liquid all over the place. So the first stage in the remediation of that waste is to actually solidify it. And we've got about 4,000 litres of this stuff, maybe 6,000 litres of this waste originally, and on the site we've solidified about two-thirds of it, but it's not in the form that you could put in a repository. So what we're going to do is take that solidified waste, redissolve it in water, then combine it with other minerals that we need to form the Synroc. Then we dry that off, then by processing involving high pressures, we'll convert it into Synroc.
Right, so what happens next?
What we've got then will be a black powder. We put the black powder in a can, weld the can closed and heat the whole lot up to 1200 degrees at 100 megapascals of pressure. And when we've done that, we've got this black dense solid contained in this rather bent-looking stainless steel metal can.
So this is an example of what it would look like, these little round...
Maybe 15 centimetres wide by about 20 centimetres high, and the whole thing weighing about 6 or 7 kilograms.
And how much waste would that represent? Would that represent a week's worth of waste or a month or a year's?
This waste that we've produced over the last 30 years or so, that would constitute about 0.1%, a bit more than that. When all the liquid's converted into solid, there'll be about 1.5 or 2 tonnes of it total.
Right. Well, quite a lot, but not so much if you think of it as over a 30-year process.
No, that's right. 2 tonnes basically occupies about maybe a cubic metre, a bit less.
Now, this is still radioactive.
Oh, yeah.
So you've still got to get rid of it somewhere.
That's right. And then now the federal government's approved a repository for this purpose up in Northern Territory. And again, in the fullness of time, these compacted materials, the Synrox, they'd be trucked up there or sent by rail to that repository, maybe 0.5 kilometre down under the Earth's surface. And we'd say even if the repository flooded from day one, probably last a million years, probably easy.
Now, what's the big advantage of Synroc over other ways of disposing of this waste?
The big advantage, I guess, is the fundamental insolubility in water of our materials, so that the radionuclides can be contained and not go back to where people live.
Now, this technology is being taken up by the British.
Yes, it has. They approached us in 2001 to see if we could do something with some of their plutonium-bearing wastes.
So this is rather nastier waste than you've been talking about dealing with here.
Different. It's not nasty, but it's a different sort of chemical composition. So we had to come up with a new Synroc-type formulation, and we basically succeeded in that. And so now they've accepted our material and they're proceeding to actually immobilise a few tonnes of this surplus plutonium.
So individual rocks for individual products?
That's right, yeah. For different wastes, it's actually different collections of rocks.
Is that difficult?
Not now, because we've got 25 years of experience in this field.
Okay, now what is the big advantage of this system over their other system? They were actually encasing their waste in glass, weren't they?
That's right. The rest of the British, their waste glass is still a prime candidate, but the success of our work basically demonstrated that Synroc was better than glass for immobilising plutonium.
So is there a lot of money in this for the Australians now?
We hope there is. We've done $1 million worth of work for British over the last year. That's ramping up slowly. We're talking about £1 million a year in 2008 and maybe a continued ramp up beyond then.
Lou Vance at Lucas Heights with Pauline Newman, and they don't actually have the patent for Synroc, but they do have the skills. Well, all that reminded me of a poem about neutrinos, little members of the nuclear zoo that can pass through anything, even Synroc, without difficulty. Now, this may be a tough call, but I've got about 20 Occam's Razor books to give away. So, can you identify the author of this poem? It's read by Arthur Dignam.
Neutrinos, they are very small. They have no charge and have no mass and do not interact at all. The Earth is just a silly ball to them, through which they simply pass. Like dust maids down a draughty hall, or photons through a sheet of glass. They snub the most exquisite gas, ignore the most substantial wall, cold shoulder steel and sounding brass, insult the stallion in his stall, and, scorning barriers of class, infiltrate you and me. Like tall and painless guillotines, they fall down through our heads into the grass. At night they enter at Nepal and pierce the lover and his lass from underneath the bed. You call it wonderful. I call it crass.
So who wrote that? A leading American author. Answers by email, please, from the Science Show website. And I'll send out some copies of Asimov's Elephant, the latest book from our programme Occam's Razor. And this is The Science Show on ABC Radio National and on MP3 audio. Well, I doubt that the Square Kilometre Array will be able to detect neutrinos, but it will be able to lift a veil on other denizens of the universe. And we in Western Australia may be the ones to build and run it. Here's Priscilla Clayton in Geraldton, Western Australia, who is waiting and waiting for signs of good news.
The Square Kilometre Array is an international radio telescope project, and currently Australia is bidding for it against three other countries, China, South Africa and Argentina, and of course ourselves. And if the project should get a Guernsey for Australia, it'll probably be sited in the Midwest region, and in particular the Murchison region of the Midwest.
And that's, what, 6 hours' drive away from where we're standing in Geraldton?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. 6 hours' drive from Geraldton. And the reason for that is because it's radio quiet, and really you get that with isolation.
In optical astronomy, you're worried about light, the street lighting and all the other kind of light pollution you get in a big city, but it's very quiet radio-wise, where you're saying in the Murchison as well.
That's right, yes, it's very, very quiet.
What does it not have?
Well, for a start, it doesn't have mobile phones running around the place or CB radios, not very many aircraft, and not many people.
Where you have people, you have radio noise.
Absolutely.
So that's the idea. What will be built there should we win?
Okay, should we win the site bid, what will be built there would be radio telescopes. In other words, something similar to the park dishes.
Big dishes, yeah.
Big dishes. At the moment, the technology side of things is still being determined, so they're still carrying out many tests in that area, but that's what will happen.
The other Australia telescope near Narrabri, there's a whole procession of these dishes, scores of them.
Well, for the whole of the project, I know, I think they're talking about the core as well as the outer arrays. Now, the core area would be in the Murchison area, and more than half would be going in there. But the other array stations will be going as far as the East Coast and also in New Zealand as well. So you're talking about quite a few. Light footprint in the sense that, unlike mining, we're not digging up anything or, you know, churning out the earth. It'll sit down quietly, won't do anything except for listening to radio signals. And the light footprint, that term has actually been used by the Aboriginal community who support the project in our region.
When is the decision to be made?
Okay, originally we were told that the site selection decision will be announced in about 2006. The site bid actually closes in December this year, so we would have had to wait probably a good 10 to 12 months before it was announced. But more recently, I think in the last 2 weeks or so, I found out that it'll actually be in 2007 now, and that's because of the funding cycle of the 17 other countries involved with the project.
It's an awful long time to hang about, isn't it?
It is, actually, but from what I've also been told, there will be a preliminary site decision announced in 2006, but the final decision won't be announced until about a year after that. So we'll just have to keep our fingers crossed that we come across, you know, as number one both times.
You're feeling nervous?
Look, no, I don't think so. I think, you know, all you can do is to give it your best shot, and then basically it's in the lap of the gods, yeah.
What would the array do that some of the big sophisticated radio telescopes, of which you, you know, you mentioned the Parkes already, which is a grand old lady. So what can you do with an array like that that you can't do with the normal ones that are around, have been around for some time?
Okay, I think because there's so many array stations involved, you can actually get finer images, and I think that's the big advantage over it. And I suppose it's the next generation radio telescopes that are being built. As you said, the grand old lady just turned 40. This is brand new technology, so hopefully it should be bigger and better.
And when you get the nod, with any luck, will it be a shock to the district having all those people turn up and a new town being built, who knows, and even though a temporary one, but will it be a major industrial enterprise getting this stuff up?
Well, look, absolutely, and I think that's why the Commission is so supportive of it, because we're talking about generating quite a few jobs for the Midwest, and I'm not talking about just, you know, menial jobs. We're talking about attracting international quality academics to the region as well. And a lot of the small rural towns in the Murchison especially, you know, even 10 people, 10 families make a huge impact on that town, in the sense that, you know, there'll be schools, doctor services, shops, and it just goes on. So if you're talking about a lot more than 20 people coming to join your community, you can see the spin-off impacts are going to be tremendous. So that's why the Commission actually supports a project.
Priscilla Clayton from the Development Commission in Geraldton, Western Australia. Now something from next week, a bit of a treat. Someone with a spectacular history in astronomy, but as an artist. John Lomberg is the man who designed the graphic on Voyager, the spacecraft now way out beyond Pluto and Neptune, beyond even where the sun's influence can reach. So far away, it's almost unimaginable. John Lomberg puts it this way.
In astronomy, the distances are so large that we can't really use miles or kilometers. That would be like measuring the distance from Sydney to New York in millimeters. You get a very large number that doesn't really mean anything to most people. So one way of illustrating it is by using the speed of light. That is, how far does light, which travels 300,000 kilometers a second, how distant are objects compared to that? And I noticed that a car that I drive, a Honda Civic that I bought in Toronto in 1986, and I had back and forth across North America several times, drove it out again to California and had it shipped over to Hawaii when I moved to Hawaii, and then used it for years as my primary car in Hawaii, and I still use it. It's a great car. It still works. And about a year ago, the odometer kicked over 300,000 kilometers, which meant that I had gone one light second. In all of that driving, for all of those years, I had just reached one light second. So I decided to have a party for my car to honor that occasion. And when I thought about all the driving I had done being spanned by a beam of light in a second, it gave me some feel for how vast the distances in space really are.
Canadian John Lomberg, who talks about Voyager and Carl Sagan, next week in The Science Show. We shall also find the first credible use for those water bottles you buy, and hear why they're tracking the genes from the Viking invasion in Britain. On Catalyst, coming up on ABC Television, bird flu, and more bird flu, vaccines and possible carriers, with Karina Kelly and Paul Willis, who'd frighten any bird away with just one look. Production for today's Science Show by Polly Rickard, David Fisher and Janita Palmer. I'm Robbie Williams. Not frightening at all.
Yeah, not frightening. Just a grumpy old bugger.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net, as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.